police use of force against communities of color has ignited protests across the country. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There is distrust between the two groups, and it's once again brought to light in the protests that have at times turned violent in South Florida. Today, we're talking with Broward Sheriff Gregory Toney. We'll ask him what he's doing to build that trust. Also, Governor Ron DeSantis' campaign was largely about how he would reshape the Florida Supreme Court. Recently, he placed two new justices on the court. They are young, and they share a libertarian view of the law. Both come from South Florida. Finally,
from their living rooms and my bathroom where I was holding my rehearsals,
artists, musicians, and actors have had to rethink how they work and make a living. We're going to hear from WLRN's Christine DiMattei about her new project to highlight their stories. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Protests continued in South Florida yesterday over the death of George Floyd, this despite the bad weather. The protests remained relatively small in size compared to those over the weekend, and they remain peaceful. More details are emerging about the events that took place on Sunday in Fort Lauderdale. The Miami Herald reported one protester was sent to the intensive care unit after her skull was cracked by a rubber foam bullet. In Miami, a WSVN social media producer was arrested and charged while covering the protest. He's been released, and those charges have since been dropped. Many questions have been raised about law enforcement's conduct during these demonstrations and what actions should be taken if things get out of hand. Joining us now is Broward County Sheriff Gregory Toney. Sheriff Toney, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Hello, sir. Thanks for having me on again.
And I just want to mention that if you have a question for the sheriff about anything, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. You can also email us sundial@wlrnnews.org. Sheriff, in the protests like Broward County has experienced in the past week, what is the BSO protocol? How are you supposed to handle crowds, marches, and protests?
Well, I think it's good to start out with explaining to the community that the protests that we had, both the one that occurred in front of headquarters in which I participated, went out and spoke to the community, let them know we were in support, as well as the Black Lives Matter movement, which took place over in Fort Lauderdale, were actually done in such a professional and non-controversial manner. I was proud to see our community come out and voice their concerns and do the things that we would expect of them to do in terms of complying. With that being said, Louis, unfortunately, just like we've seen across the country, there has been a few agitators who have taken advantage of peaceful protests and tried to turn it into a manner of disruption. And so we are aware of that from the sheriff's office. Fort Lauderdale was aware that this type of activity could occur. And we wanted to make sure that we did everything possible to mitigate any unnecessary form of violence and arrest. And I think, you know, with these agitators participating and doing the things that they did, there was a good reduction on anything getting really bad here in Broward.
And we look at the thing that happened in Fort Lauderdale. I mean, we're looking at the story of the police officer. Now, this is Fort Lauderdale Police. This is not your department, but it's the story of the police officer who shoved a woman who was kneeling. That officer has been suspended and is being investigated. And people in the crowd say that's what started it. Of course, we're hearing both sides of the story. But, I mean, for the Fort Lauderdale event, that's really where the center of all of this seems to be going.
Sure. You know, I can tell you, you know, from just the law enforcement side, the chief over there has taken a proactive step to make sure he examine and hold people accountable. But during that event, you know, listen to communication channels and many different moving parts. Once these agitators start getting things going, I just start seeing a difference in how things were going to have to be handled and responded to. I can tell you if it was one of my deputies or so that had participated in that type of activity, we would definitely be investigating and make sure we held people accountable. The last thing we need is more controversy and conflict amongst law enforcement and the community.
What is the protocol when you're, I want to understand the training for any law enforcement agent, you know, going into a situation like this. You have hundreds, if not thousands of people marching. And as you said, there are going to be agitators. But what's the training in how you're supposed to handle this? How you're supposed to deal with these large crowds? And knowing that some, in some cases, you're going to have people who are angry, filled with rage, and they may be saying really horrible things at you.
Well, the key thing is de-escalation training and movement techniques. So for our typical, our quick response force, or better phrase, our riot control teams, they are highly trained. These are some of our top-notch officers. And the training that we provide to them are consistent with all the national standards for any type of riot control procedures. Ideally, the goal is always to try to control the environment and move people out without any type of conflict. And so when you look at TV and you notice that law enforcement officers are standing with their shields, they're pushing towards the crowd, the idea is to move them out of the area so that there's no long sustained opportunity for disruption, property damage, or violence to occur. So, you know, the tactics and techniques are really quite simple. I think it's a matter of the people that are hired and assigned to these responsibilities, making sure they have the level of discipline and patience to, you know, enact the minimum level of force when doing so.
So who makes the final decision, though? For example, if when tear gas is used, rubber bullets are used, who's making that final decision? I mean, are the officers, the deputies who are on the ground, do they make that decision if they feel things are getting out of hand, or does that have to come from somewhere else?
There's a combination of effects that could happen there. But what I would tell you is each team, in this case, we were supporting Fort Lauderdale. So Fort Lauderdale was the incident commander for all tactical operations and movements that would take place there. But you have to remember, you can't control all these things from a distance operation center. Supervisors and team leaders are assigned and given the autonomy to make decisions out there based on what type of threat they're dealing with or how the environment is changing. So it's twofold. It's an administrative level, and then there's a field level.
Now, are you looking for agitators? Are you looking for the people who might be out of control?
I think, yeah, early on, you know, as we continue to look at the intelligence that's coming through and the social media networks and potential threats, it's clear that it is a small pocket of agitators who are seeking to disrupt these peaceful, positive protests that are currently across the county and in the country, for that matter.
And I have to ask, because, I mean, you know, I'm not one of the reporters who goes out in the field. I'm a person who spends a lot of time here in the studio. But this is a question we've been asking of ourselves as journalists. Because of what we've seen over the last couple of days, journalists attacked by protesters, but also by the police, and some injured. I mean, you know, what is the protocol in that situation when you know, you see a person and they have ID and or they have cameras and they're, you know, or they're doing reporting? I mean, are you trying to push them out as well?
I think oftentimes with the, from a media standpoint, the ability to get out and cover the story is such a level of importance for the media networks. However, when they're in an environment with hundreds and hundreds of people, it's very difficult, I would say, for law enforcement to spot and identify the media versus those who are throwing rocks or throwing stones. So it's always risky for the media to be out there. I would just, you know, tell them to take all the precautionary measures possible to make sure they don't put themselves in harm's way.
We're talking with Broward County Sheriff Gregory Toney. What questions do you have for the sheriff? You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. You can also email us, sundial@WLRNnews.org. We did get a question, Sheriff, from a listener on Facebook. Tatiana Maria asks, are you ready to implement regulations which would criminalize brutal policing and penalize your officers who display immoral and unethical practices through the justice system? Are you ready to arrest officers who use excessive force?
Well, we've already taken some very aggressive stances. And I will tell you, having been in office now for 17 months, it was a very core focus for me to change the culture of abuse or excessive force in this agency. The first step that we had to do to implement was to create an early warning system that would identify those deputies that may have shown a consistent pattern of being involved in fights, physical altercations, or any level of a force, so that we can flag them and discipline or modify their training and hold them accountable early before someone gets killed. Another level that we had to introduce was a use of force review board, which would allow a team of subject matter experts in the agency to review every single force of conduct that take place so that we can make a good decision as to was it in compliance or non-compliance. And then we have a hybrid of our professional standards committee, which is comprised of civilians, where I went out, quite frankly, hit the reset button, appointed a lot of reputable people. I assigned a judge to chair it to make sure that we would get a very thorough review and recommendations brought forth that were consistent with not only with our policies, but the public's expectations.
Is it difficult to get rid of a bad deputy, a bad officer?
Absolutely. I think it's very difficult for law enforcement administrators to remove employees due to the multitude of checks and balances and securities that's been provided to law enforcement officers under, you know, Chapter 112, for example, as well as union representation, who, quite frankly, depending on who is represented at the time, may take on a very aggressive approach to defend at all costs, even when deputies or law enforcement officers conduct themselves in a wrong manner. And we've seen that with the track record and history of the officers in Minneapolis.
Do you think that should be changed? Should it be easier to get rid of bad cops?
Absolutely. Look, we are entrusted with something very special in this country, and that's the public's trust. They have agreed under a social contract that they will respect law enforcement, that we would be under the perception that the people that are wearing this badge is of good moral standing and would not violate the laws that they've sworn to protect. And so if we get to a point where we have a few individuals who violate those trusts, violate the laws, then they should be held accountable and they should be removed from this profession.
I wanted to bring up this story. Recently, you had suspended a deputy, Ronald Thurston. He's the son of Florida Senator Perry Thurston. Ronald posted on Facebook that there were not enough African Americans in key positions. He wrote this, quote, "Vote or die," and this after he had posted a number of African Americans in key positions, pointing out not enough. Why was this against social media policy in the department?
So first, let me correct you in your statement. He was not suspended. Both Deputy Thurston and one other had violated our administrative policies and related to social media context and information that they put out. So they've been placed on restrictive duty so that internal affairs can thoroughly examine as to whether or not the nature of their comments were in violation of our policies. Now, what I will say about that is this. It's very important for us to be consistent in our activities as administrator. We can't suspend some people for violating policies. We have to make sure that we're holding everyone accountable and thoroughly examine as to whether or not they should be suspended, terminated, or any other type of discipline. And that's part of a consistent message that I've pushed out since stepping into this office.
So with any deputy, if they're breaking the rule, whether it's social media policy or if there's a complaint filed against it, what about if there is a complaint filed out in the field? What happens then?
Any complaint that is issued out in the field, regardless of, and keep in mind, Lewis, I cover the public safety responsibilities for roughly half the county, and every single one of my district commanders are charged with accepting any complaint that comes in and forwarding that information up to administration so they can be examined under a thorough internal affairs review. I think the public expects that, and we will not change or modify anything in terms of how we handle our follow-up reviews.
So the demonstrations are obviously about the death of George Floyd at the hands of police officers in Minneapolis. It's also about the death of every African American at the hands of law enforcement in cases where there were allegations of use of force against unarmed people. What I want to know, though, from you is your take on what's happening here now on the national conversation, because you're in an interesting position. You're the sheriff of one of the largest departments in the country. You're also an African-American man. So how do you approach this topic?
Well, you know, Lewis, I'll add one other. I am very uniquely qualified to speak on these issues. It's not just a matter of me being an African-American male and the chief law enforcement officer in this agency, but my life experiences. I have personally been the guy on the ground unjustly with a knee on his neck. I know what it feels like to grasp for air and hope for mercy from people who have been sworn to protect you. And so I understand the discriminatory practices that exist within the criminal justice system, not just law enforcement, but also in the Department of Corrections, as well as in our court proceedings. And so I've taken an approach of what can we do for reform immediately at the law enforcement responsibility, in which I'm tasked to control, manage, and make sure we bring equal justice amongst all people in this community. And some of the reforms that we talked about in terms of the Professional Standards Committee, the use of force review, but also I don't want to get to a point where we're always firing people. That is a very retroactive response, and that means harm has already taken place to this community. And so we have interjected new educational practices and training, starting with a huge program we're issuing out for the racial equity and implicit bias training here to mandate it amongst all law enforcement officers in this agency. And I will push this message that every single law enforcement administrator in this county would follow in the tracks that we are introducing here to make sure that we are training our men and women to be much more socially sensitive and understanding to the plights that exist here in this country when it comes to Black and brown people.
I'm talking with Broward County Sheriff Gregory Toney. Toney, again, has been outspoken since the death of George Floyd at the hands of police officers in Minneapolis. You can share your questions. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We heard from Rosianna Wynn, who tweeted at us. She was at the protest in Fort Lauderdale. She said this, quote, "I was three floors above in the parking garage with a clear view of the violence. My perspective is a little different. This could be a learning moment for both sides." We also heard from Andrea on Twitter. "A lot of protesters are calling for defunding the police force. She wants to know, Sheriff, are you willing to accept a smaller budget? And where would you make budget cuts?"
Well, I think from a budgetary aspect, you know, one of the things I had promised the county commission was that I would never step into their chambers with a wants list, and I would only come forward with a needs list. And we've been very responsible about requesting funds into this agency and using them appropriately. For years in this agency, a lot of funds were mismanaged and used in a manner that was not conducive for public safety. Last year alone, I reallocated $60 million back into public safety. We broke ground on a $30 million training center. We end up giving some of the best raises in 25 years. We built a state-of-the-art real-time crime center that safeguards our schools. Over 256 schools are being tracked and monitored for any type of violence to make sure we can intercept any type of active shooter events. And we continue to expand utilizing money the correct way, taking away the political nexus to this office and getting back to public safety.
I want to talk about training techniques. And there was an allegation about training techniques within the BSO. Later, an investigation found that sparring was brought into training sessions, but not takedown techniques. And this, of course, all came after the story of the African-American teen, DeLuca Roll, who was caught on tape. He was on the ground. Deputy Christopher Krikovich was on top of him, punched him in the head. What can you tell me about training techniques in a situation, again, where you have a crowd and you have someone that you need to either get control of or you need to just defuse the situation? What is your deputy taught as to how they're supposed to handle that and how to, I guess, subdue somebody?
Sure. So I'll start with this. Of course, that comment that came up earlier about the new techniques that we were introducing, much more aggressive tactics, was false and not true. We have not changed any policies, protocols, or procedures in terms of defensive tactics. We are still focusing on de-escalation techniques and making sure that we are not unnecessarily using levels of force that are not consistent with the nature of the threat. And I'll summarize it very shortly for the public, because I always try not to complex the nature of policies and protocols. Use of force comes down to really a very simple practice, and when we examine it, and that is, was the level of force we used necessary? Was it reasonable for what we were dealing with? And was it proportional to the nature of the threat? Those three things really are the guiding principles for all defensive tactics. And so when we recognized and saw that DeLuca Roll was slammed into the ground, that was very much excessive for what we were dealing with, which was really no more than just an obstruction charge. And I had to go against the Professional Standards Committee that was constructed under my predecessor, who exonerated that individual, and I terminated him. And I terminated him, Lewis, understanding that we cannot, again, allow for patterns of excessive force to fester into killing someone by holding a knee on their neck.
I want to ask about the tools that officers use in these cases. Again, like with the protests, and, you know, we talk about the tear gas, but also especially the rubber bullets. I've looked extensively at these less than lethal tools that officers will use. They're still powerful. I mean, I've shot some of them. They're really powerful. What do you think about the tools that are used? Do you think that those are appropriate? Because, again, we look at the woman you know, whose skull was cracked by a rubber bullet. There was a reporter who lost an eye, you know, as well. I mean, what do you think about the foam rubber bullets and other tools like that?
Well, I think all those different events that you described where people were hurt, they're horrendous. And that's not the intent of what law enforcement officers are using these items for. And the reason why they're less impactful in the sense that they're rubber or they're foam is to mitigate any type of harm from that you described, cracking skulls and things of that nature. But unfortunately, until we can come up as our engineers and experts in this area with better means to be able to de-escalate and not even come into physical contact, those are the twos that we are currently limited with in terms of what's allowed to be used for those riot incidents or less lethal encounters.
But you, I mean, look, you could say intent, but I mean, intent doesn't matter. It happened. Do you think that there could be a better way?
I would hope that we can discover some better mechanisms in place, for sure. I am not an engineer. I'm not a tech guy. I don't design and create different type of less lethal, but I think it makes sense for us to put more money and funding and research because even like to your point, you may have the intent not to harm someone, but yet to the situations you described, someone's skull was cracked, someone lost an eye. And that is a very egregious thing to happen. And I feel sorry for all those people who suffered that.
I wanted to ask you about trust, the trust between law enforcement and especially communities of color. And again, something that you can speak to. We talked with State Representative Chevron Jones of Broward County yesterday, and he was part of those protests over the weekend. And I asked him, I said, do you trust law enforcement? This is what he said.
The answer is no. Even when I get pulled over by the police officer, even I, in my position, am still scared because I've seen what your capabilities are. You've shown us time and time again what your capabilities are. Even if I'm innocent, even if I don't have anything in my car, you've shown us.
What do you say to the fact that you have a state lawmaker and he's afraid, he does not trust law enforcement, and he's in a position of power?
Look, I know Chevron very well, and I understand where he's coming from because I've had my own encounters. I've been that guy who's been stopped for driving a nice car. I told you I've been the guy with the knee on his neck. But I've also been the guy who have been through the doors with some of the bravest people that has walked this earth. And they live right here in Broward County, and they wear a badge on their chest. These individuals who step outside the lines of normalcy and violate the laws and use racism and racial profiling to tarnish law enforcement reputation are exactly the ones that we need to rid our organizations of. So I agree with him when it comes to that small pocket of individuals who are violating the things, but we also need to understand the long-term cultural existence of conflict and distrust between Black and Brown people. I often speak to young people in this community about the reminder that this very uniform that I wear, and I wear it honorably, and I admire anyone who suits up. But the reality of it is the civil rights movement, there was the very same uniform that unleashed dogs on Black and Brown people. And it's a generational experience as our parents educate us about these things. Even my fire rescue personnel, we were deploying fire hoses on Black and Brown people. And so to minimize that distrust is gonna take a lot more relationship building, a lot more understanding, a lot more diversification, and a lot more training.
And talking about that trust, part of it is in trusting in leaders like you. But I need to bring this up. This is about some of your past that has been brought up. And I wanted to ask you about the reporting that was done from the Florida Bulldog to the Miami Herald to the Sun Sentinel about the story of you when you were 14 years old and you had shot and killed an intruder. No charges brought against you in the case, but we're learning about this now. How do we trust you? How do we trust our leaders if the stories like this are coming out so much later?
Yeah, I think part of this biggest thing, as you know, Lewis, is about politics. And the fact that I have taken some very strong stances against individuals, they want to deflect the truth of the matter about the great performances this administration is accomplishing by trying to tarnish a very traumatic childhood experience where I had to survive an armed suspect coming in to kill me and my brother. And there has been this misconception that I've never brought this up. I've communicated in church. I've talked to friends. And so, you know, this is not something that I have shied away from. But the reality of it is there's not an obligation to tell everyone you meet. But now that it is out there, I have gotten tons of emails and phone calls, and a lot of young people are saying, wow, the sheriff made it from some of the worst situations in American history when it comes to the crime patterns that saturated and consumed North Philadelphia Badlands, as it was coined. And so I'm proud of my past and what I've had to endure, and I'm going to continue to use it as a driving force, not only for justice in this agency, but to inspire young people who think that their circumstances can dictate their outcome.
I do have to ask you about the other accusation that's been popped that brought up about the use of LSD. Again, allegations that you were turned down for a job because you mentioned that you'd used it, but then you didn't mention it another time to get a job. What about that accusation?
Yeah, again, this is still part of that same consistent pattern of, let's dive back 27, 17, 20 years ago and pull up applications and things that was checked off on and inaccurate and never had a chance to really explain. But I'm not going to continue to be distracted with these things. Lewis, what people need to know and care about is, are they much safer than they was before I came in here? Is the money being used appropriately? Are we holding people accountable? Are we advancing the safety protocols for this community? I would love to spend 4 or 5 hours debating and talking about that with any of my opposition who is seeking this office for sake of their own personal gain.
Now, these questions of these allegations too, though, come to, and I understand your point that you're not going to mention it to everybody you run into, but for a person in your position, how much should we as the public know? How much would you want to know about somebody who wants to become a deputy within your department?
I think all the different administrative levels of questions and comments that exist in this agency suffice. You know, I'm not going to dive back into what someone was involved in when they were 13, 14, 15 years old, when they had been, you know, in my case, you're 41 years old. You're one of the most decorated police officers in your agency's history. You've created so many other life-saving techniques and things. What's the measuring standpoint for the community? You know, what is their expectation for the people who serve?
Let me finish with this. I'm going to come back to what Chevron Jones said a moment ago, which is not having trust in law enforcement. So how do you help build that trust? How do you get, especially communities of color, to trust and believe in those brave men and women that you talk about? Because, yes, as we know, I think most officers, most deputies are good people. They're humans like the rest of us, doing a tough job, but they don't trust them. So how do you build that trust?
Yeah, you know, one of the things I learned early on was under my, you know, predecessors and other administrations, there was this notion to take out the policing and community policing because of exactly what you're saying, that the public distrusts law enforcement. I think that's a flawed philosophy. You don't take the police out of the community. You put them in the community and you ensure that the community understands and see them and get to know each other on a personal basis. I will tell you the one thing that I do recognize that went right in Philadelphia in terms of community policing. The police officer there has walked the beat. They knew our mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers. We knew them on a first name basis. There was a clear understanding of the social problems that was occurring in the community. And it wasn't about running out and arresting everybody for every single violation. They were engaged with fixing the social issues in the community to help reduce having to get involved in criminal arrests. And we've done that. I've reinstituted and designed a neighborhood support team. This past year, we've been out on a lot of different social meetings and town halls. Our officers are out of their cars. We instituted something called a park walk and talk, where the officers are walking through their business districts, walking in their apartment complexes, communicating with the people in the neighborhood. And I know it's working effectively because in a short time frame where we had enacted this in August of last year, we had over 10,000 park walk and talks that were initiated, self-initiated work by the police officers. And the response has been, hey, Sheriff, we like that the deputies are in here. We love that they're walking in the neighborhoods. They're talking to us about real problems that are occurring. I just think we need to continue that with the sensitivity training.
He is Broward County Sheriff Gregory Tony. Sheriff Tony, as always, I really appreciate the time.
Yes, thank you. We'll do it again. Have a good one, Lewis.
All right. Stay safe. Again, you can continue this conversation and go to our social media, WLRN Sundial, or again, you can email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Now, we're still hearing from you. We heard from an anonymous source who asked not to be named. He said, "As a union laborer, I have seen the internal politics, nepotism, and many otherwise shady activities. I try to be pro-union for the sake of what unions once represented, but when the police unions and even my own protect the people who shouldn't be protected and cutting loose those who make it hard." Thank you again for sharing your comments. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, how Governor DeSantis has shaped the Florida Supreme Court for years, maybe decades to come. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Governor Ron DeSantis recently appointed two new justices to the state Supreme Court. Both of them are from South Florida. Justice Renata Francis from the Palm Beach County Circuit Court is the first woman of Jamaican descent on the state's high court. John Correal is with the Miami-based firm Cobra and Kim. His father emigrated from Cuba as part of Operation Pedro Pan back in the 1960s. And they both spoke at a news conference in Miami a couple weeks ago.
I am grateful to the people of the state of Florida who welcomed my parents to our country 60 years ago, when they and their parents sought justice, a better life, and most of all, freedom.
As a student of history growing up, I was and remain in awe of the United States, its constitution, its freedoms, its respect for the rule of law, and I wanted to be a part of that story. And so, like generations before me, this young immigrant girl set out to find her place in this shining city on the hill.
Well, joining us now to discuss the new makeup of the court is Steve Contorno with the Tampa Bay Times. We're also going to be talking about the latest update on the Republican National Convention. But, Steve, great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
So, three Supreme Court justices retired last year. What was the makeup of the court before DeSantis took office?
Prior to DeSantis taking office, there were a lot of 4-3 decisions that tended to favor, I don't want to say favor Democrats, but certainly leaned more skeptical of actions taken by Republican legislatures in the past and the administration. One of the more famous dust-ups between the court and the legislature was the redistricting fight of the last decade. And it was one of the sort of last checks on Republicans having total power control in Tallahassee. Flash forward to today, the court is now all appointed by Republican governors. Six of those probably consider themselves more conservative. And so now we have this court that some have called one of the more conservative courts in the entire country.
And we knew this was coming because there's a rule that justices have to retire by a certain age. So we knew before DeSantis took over, this was a key issue for the governor's race.
And he certainly made it a very large piece of his platform, very similar to President Trump, who after he won the primary, tried to win over skeptical conservatives by assuring them he would make very conservative Supreme Court justice picks. And Governor DeSantis followed a similar playbook where he very early in the campaign talked about the fact that the next governor would get to appoint these justices and how critical it would be to elect a Republican as a result.
Now, I wanted to ask you about this group called the Federalist Society. Tell me a little bit about who they are and how they approach legal issues.
They're a group of lawyers and judges who tend to follow libertarian, conservative, ideological lines when it comes to politics. And when it comes to looking at the law, they tend to adopt a more textualist idea. That is a concept that was modernized and made famous by the late Justice Antonin Scalia. And it really doesn't allow justices to bring other sorts of factors into the equation when they're making decisions, things like legislative intent, things like judicial philosophy. It's really more of they claim it's a very ironclad sort of way to approach the case. And it doesn't leave opportunities for judges to inject their own opinion and beliefs, and that's at least the pathos behind it.
And the reason I bring up this question about the Federalist Society is because the two new Supreme Court picks were part of the Federalist Society, right?
They were, and so is Governor DeSantis, and he has tapped the Federalist Society to help him vet his picks, and he has bragged about this. This is not necessarily a secret. This has been a pretty much a big piece of his vetting process for these judges. And he's done something very notable. There's a trend in not just that they're all Federalist Society members or people who have been vetted by this organization, but they're also really young or younger people who have the same sort of judicial philosophy. And in that case, he has ensured that the Federalist Society will have an impact on this court for potentially 2.5 decades.
There are some big cases that this court is set to face in the near future. Now, again, as we said, I mean, Republicans wanted to push the court to lean a little bit more on their side. What are a couple of the big cases that they hope now the court's going to be on their side with?
I think you're going to see an immediate push for more anti-abortion laws. Already, the legislature has passed a bill that would make it so parents have to provide consent in order to for a minor to get an abortion. This is something that the previous Supreme Court struck down, and it will be tested early. And based off of how they proceed on this case, it could open the floodgates to a whole host of other anti-abortion legislation, even a heartbeat bill. Redistricting is sure to come up these next 10 years as the census numbers come in, so that's another one. And then the issue over whether private or taxpayer money should go to pay for private schools. The expansion of the voucher program is already something that Governor DeSantis has championed that was struck down by a previous court when it was passed by Governor Bush. So they're testing that again. And it doesn't even seem like on that one there will be a legal challenge, because I think many assume that the outcome is all but guaranteed.
And as you pointed out, they are younger. They're in their 40s. So if they don't have to retire until their 70s, he is reshaping the court again for decades, not just years. I'm talking with Steve Contorno, the political editor for the Tampa Bay Times. Again, Governor DeSantis recently appointing John Coryell and Renata Francis to the bench, both from South Florida. You can read more of Steve's reporting on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I want to transition over to Governor DeSantis to his friend in Washington, D.C. It's fair to say they are friends, President Donald Trump. President Trump is looking for a place to host the Republican National Convention this summer. The reason why, it's supposed to be in Charlotte, but Governor Roy Cooper of North Carolina has stated that they can't accommodate a full-scale RNC because of the pandemic. So, well, the president's home is Florida. That's been brought up, right, as a potential replacement?
Yeah, there's some creative solutions that I think may materialize in the coming weeks. But the president last night said that he won't be giving his acceptance speech in Charlotte. And so the governor, like you said, he's a friend of the president, and he has opened his arms to hosting the convention. But I don't know if we will see a full-scale moving of a convention in the traditional sense to Florida. An idea that was floated to me last week by an advisor to the 2020 host committee is having the convention business, counting the delegates, voting on a platform, all that will take place in Charlotte. And then president and his family and his key surrogates can have sort of a roving convention on the road where they go to, Jacksonville one night and Las Vegas another, and maybe somewhere in Texas or Atlanta, and hold these multi-day rallies that really have the flair and all the the balloon drop and all the pomp of a convention, but take it on the road and do it sort of rally style in the way that you've seen from the president in the past.
Yeah. And just as a note, Governor DeSantis did say in a news conference today the state's position on hosting it. He said, quote, default yes. Of course, he would say that. But the thing about holding, the RNC or the DNC, these are huge events. They take a long time to plan and prepare. So basically, are we saying we're not going to see, as you said, this may be in multiple cities, lots of smaller events. So the idea of the RNC is pretty much gone, what we're used to seeing.
Everyone I've talked to said it would be very difficult. These things take tens of millions of dollars. They take a lot of security planning. The 2012 convention that was in Tampa required almost 2 years of planning, $55 million. Police were brought in from all over the state. It was really almost like a militarized zone for that week when the delegates were in town. There's five times as much media as a Super Bowl, for example. And finding hotel rooms for all these people, doing background checks, all that is incredibly difficult and a logistical nightmare. To pull it off in 3 months seems very difficult. But the president has a tried and true playbook of holding rallies across the country at arenas. And that's what gives them a potential leg up if they choose to do that as an alternative to a more traditional convention.
And what about the Democratic National Convention? They're confirmed for Milwaukee, but I haven't heard anything about what they're doing.
Right. It sounds like they are inching towards a delay. In fact, I'm not positive, but they may have already gone in that direction of delaying the convention into August. And then, if it hasn't subsided, if the coronavirus threat remains, switching to a virtual convention. And we're starting to see former Vice President Joe Biden hold these digital events where he's sort of testing how to campaign in this new world. You might have two very different alternative conventions this year, given the state of the country right now, and with both parties going very different routes to accommodate the concerns over the pandemic.
Everything has changed this year, that's for sure. Steve Contorno, political editor for the Tampa Bay Times. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And you can read more of Steve's reporting on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, conducting music from the bathroom or a ballet in the living room. Artists are getting creative during this pandemic. Mi piace. Ma sono cotta di te, mi piaci, ah, mi piaci. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The coronavirus pandemic has shut down art venues. Think about the last time you went to a theater, maybe a concert or museum. That doesn't mean that South Florida artists have slowed down. Many are bringing these experiences to their audiences virtually through social media and live stream events. WLRN morning anchor Christine DiMattei has been profiling these artists and their creative projects in a new series called Intermission. And she spoke with our engagement editor, Katie Lepre.
A few weeks ago, you started this project called Intermission. Can you tell me more about it?
Sure. You know, Katie, when the coronavirus pandemic first struck South Florida in earnest, I was astonished and delighted, but not too terribly surprised, to see how South Florida artists and arts venues and arts organizations really rose to the challenge and started reaching out to their audiences. Because as an artist, as an arts organization, if you don't have people in that theater, what are you going to do? It's not only a matter of ticket sales, it's a matter of just staying connected with your audience.
Why did you feel like there was a need to start this project to begin with?
It's critical. Not only do I love the arts, but WLRN has a very, very strong bond with South Florida's arts community. And along with the political stories that we cover and the economic stories that we cover and human interest and social justice, etc., we cover a lot of arts. And we didn't want to create the impression that the arts in South Florida has just disappeared, because they haven't. Even though they're not in those physical theaters, those physical venues, they're still very much alive.
You've heard from ballerinas from Miami City Ballet performing in their living rooms and the salutes of frontline workers to classical musicians who have taken to YouTube. What are some of the stories that have really resonated with you so far?
Well, Katie, there's a really poignant one. Recently, I interviewed the co-founder of a dance company, and for their 20th anniversary extravaganza, they were going to invite a company from Italy, which, as you know, has been very, very hard hit. And naturally, that extravaganza, that 20th anniversary performance, had to be canceled for the stage, but they did bring it online. And they couldn't have, naturally, of course, the Italian company. But what they did do was a salute to Italy.
Mi piaci. Mi piaci.
Not only a tribute to their fellow dancers, but a salute to a country that's been very, very hard hit by this pandemic.
What other kinds of experiences or stories would you like to hear?
I'd really like to hear from people who have given birth to their inner artist during quarantine or self-isolation. You know, for instance, I've already heard from somebody who is a journalist, but he likes to do political cartoons in his spare time. And I got to tell you, shout out to our own Luis Hernandez here, who has discovered or rediscovered his talents as an artist and actually did our intermission logo. That artwork is his, folks.
What have been some of the through-line challenges you've heard about creative producing from home?
Well, it's pretty much the challenges that most anybody would have when they're working at home. You've got a delay, which makes things difficult for musicians. They can't play together in most cases. You've got an image that you're looking at, and somebody is looking back at you through a computer screen, and that poses a problem for dancers. It's like, which leg are you on? Well, I don't know. And the first intermission profile I did was with a young choreographer by the name of Durante Verzola. He was self-quarantined in his home in Kansas City, and he described holding Zoom rehearsals with Miami City Ballet dancers from their homes here in South Florida, and he described how it all came together.
And so after we spent a few days creating the piece through these online rehearsals from their living rooms and my bathroom where I was holding my rehearsals, then we took each of the dancers into the Miami City Ballet Studios so that we could give a beautiful backdrop for the dance and create kind of a dance film to present this work.
And then that ballet made its world premiere on Facebook. Also, you've got things going on in your home, like your children milling about, like your spouse milling about trying to cook dinner. And also, it was funny to see a ballerina in her tutu in her living room during a rehearsal shooing her cat out of the shot. That was hilarious. So these are the sorts of challenges that crop up.
Have any online communities for the arts been cultivated because of the pandemic?
Plenty. I have seen so many, it's unreal. I would say virtually all of them, beginning with what I call the biggies, the three major performing arts centers, Kravis, Broward Center for the Performing Arts, and Arscht. All three of them have been unstoppable, indefatigable when it comes to reaching out to their audiences with virtual classes and online sessions and Q&As, everything to keep their audiences interested until they can come back again.
Until we can get back to our seats, this is what exists in the interim. As an avid arts patron, what has it been like for you to engage with performing arts in this way?
Honestly, simultaneously heartbreaking and uplifting. Agonizing, Katie, because when I first moved to South Florida, I didn't come as a broadcaster, I came as an actor. And this arts community embraced me. And it was just lovely to come from a place like New York where you're just a drop in the ocean to a community like this that really, really appreciates everyone who wants to be a part of it. And it's so hard to hear these stories of artists, of singers, of dancers, actors, opera singers longing to be on stage again, and they can't right now. Uplifting because they have smiled throughout this. They have refused to give up their sense of humor.
Why did you want to focus on the experience of artists during this pandemic?
We hear so much of what this health crisis is doing to other industries. I think it's important to hear what it's doing to arts venues as well. Because as Mr. Keating said in Dead Poets Society,
medicine, law, business, engineering, These are noble pursuits and necessary to sustain life. But poetry, beauty, romance, love, these are what we stay alive for.
It's literature, it's art, it's dance, it's music. These are the things that we live for.
That was WLRN morning anchor Christine DiMattei speaking with WLRN's engagement editor Katie Lepre. WLRN's series Intermission looks at how South Florida's art community is using social media and online events to connect with the audiences during this social distancing. So if you're an artist or an arts organization doing just that, tell us your story. You can email us, talktous@wlrnnews.org. Put the word intermission in the subject line, please. You can always call, too, 305-376-3777. Again, that's 305-376-3777. Well, that's our Sundial program for this Wednesday, June 3rd. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we're going to continue our conversation about the protests surrounding the death of George Floyd and police brutality against communities of color. Could a civilian investigative panel charged with examining cases of police brutality be part of the solution? Plus, testing our sewage could help us predict the next wave of COVID-19 infections. A program in Miami-Dade County has been sending sewage in Boston to be tested. We're going to learn about this new innovative method of tracing the virus. Plus, gyms are reopening in Broward and Palm Beach County, still closed to Miami-Dade, though. If you've been going to the gym, what's the experience been like? Do you feel safe using the equipment? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.